The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're coming at you with a listener mail episode today, but we're broadcasting from the depths. We're down here in a nuclear submarine, it happens, because apparently Submarine Command has appropriated our mailbot Carney.
Yeah, we call it Deep Star 7, and that's where we're hanging out for this episode. Yeah, Carney's been working down here in the deep, in the shadowy depths, which is perfect, because some of the listener mail that we're going to be reading here today does relate to our recent episode on studies related to sleep and even dreaming within the confines of a nuclear ballistic missile submarine.
Now, as always, we've got to say that we don't have time to respond to or read on the podcast all of the great listener mail we get. Just rest assured, we do try to read it all. Mm-hmm. And so thank you so much for sending it. But today you're going to get a selection of some of the stuff we've gotten since the last episode, the last listener mail episode, concerning all kinds of things, concerning quantum immortality, submarines, and the alphabet and the goddess, and all kinds of good stuff. But maybe we should start with some of the responses to the alphabet and the goddess episodes.
Yeah, we heard from a number of people about this one, in part because it does have a lot of really thought-provoking ideas in it. But then also there are some issues with some of the main pieces that Schlein was utilizing in the work.
Yeah, so if you'll recall, we did a couple episodes on this book, The Alphabet and the Goddess by Leonard Schlein. It was a book from the late 90s that made this sort of historical neuroscience argument that the rise of patriarchy and the decline or the relative decline of the power of goddesses in religious pantheons around the world was somehow correlated with the rise of alphabetic writing. And mm-hmm. he makes a lot of arguments based on hemispheric lateralization of the brain and how that's correlated with gender roles and how that's correlated with alphabetic writing. And so we discussed in the original episode that we were doing the topic because we thought it was kind of thought-provoking and raised good questions, not because we were endorsing it as correct.
Right. And I think it also within the context of the episode, we discussed some of the areas where I think his argument was a bit weak, such as when it comes to Chinese writing,
yeah,
or the Hindu pantheon.
Well, and just generally the idea that I got the feeling we might be dealing with some historical cherry picking in his arguments, that he was, you know, sort of selectively emphasizing the characteristics of societies or parts of societies that helped his argument, and not necessarily always giving the most balanced reading of things.
Yeah.
Now, those were the kinds of concerns we raised in the original episode. I will say, actually, since then, I think I've become even more skeptical of his argument, because I've started to wonder if not just his argument about the explanation for the rise of patriarchy is flawed, but I wonder if some of his underlying assumptions are flawed too. Like, I think in the future, especially based on some feedback we got after the episode, that we should do an episode on the future questioning what the gender roles of prehistoric societies actually were. Like, what is the evidence from anthropology and archaeology and everything about how gender dynamics work in prehistoric societies?
Yeah, I would love to examine that, particularly when you get in not only what we can tell about ancient humans, but also ancient Neanderthals. What exactly was the dynamic, and what is the relation between that ancient dynamic and the place we are today?
Yeah, so that's an episode for the near future. Mm-hmm. But today we did want to review some of the most interesting listener mail that we got in response to the Alphabet and the Goddess episode. So, Robert, you want to jump in with the first one?
Sure. This one comes to us from Amelia. Amelia writes, I just started listening to the podcast a couple of months ago, and I've been loving it. I was especially excited when I saw the episode for the Alphabet and the Goddess. The transition from matriarchal to patriarchal religions in the ancient world was always a topic that interested me in college. I studied classical studies as a minor with a concentration on ancient Greece. I was interested to see if you would discuss a Minoan and Mycenaean culture in ancient Greece and a change in religious symbols as a part of the discussion. Since it wasn't part of the discussion, I thought I'd write in and tell you a little of what I know. The Minoans were a seafaring civilization on Crete in the Bronze Age, most famously known for its relation to King Minos and the Minotaur myths.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, Minotaur is one of my favorite monsters. I feel like one of the most underutilized monsters.
They are. They are tremendous, and I love it when somebody gets them right. The old Jim Henson Storyteller series did a pretty good job with the Minotaur. Of course, House of Leaves, the horror novel, well, we'll just say book, does a fabulous job with the Minotaur. And the Dungeons and Dragons treatment of Minotaurs is actually pretty good.
Oh, they're not just like some brute that's going to throw you around?
Well, they are a brute that'll throw you around, but they have a pretty high wisdom.
Oh, okay.
And they can't become lost in a maze.
Oh, I like that. But sorry, we should go on with Amelia's email. So after mentioning the Minoans being related to King Minos and Minotaur myths.
Yes, she continues, quote, it is thought that the snake was used as a symbol of fertility or rebirth, similar to other cultures in the Middle East. So we think there was some quote-unquote mother goddess aspect to Minoan religion and culture. As the Bronze Age progressed, the Mycenaeans settled on the mainland. They were a more patriarchal and militaristic people. They lived in citadels in the mountains and depicted soldiers in their art. Their culture can represent the invasion of the male sky god and establish ancient earth goddess religions as Indo-Europeans move south. Eventually, the Minoan culture collapsed and Mycenaean culture survived to influence the later classical Greek periods. I think the most interesting thing to me about this transition is the change in symbology that makes it to present day. We can look over time and see the snake turn from this worshipped symbol of fertility and earth to this hated symbol of trickery and evil. We see in the Bible that the snake is the tempter and the devil in the Garden of Eden. Medusa, a generally evil character in Greek myth, has hair of snakes. Could this be the patriarchal culture's way of displacing matriarchal religious symbols? Anti-snake propaganda in religious stories? It's something to think about. The Minoan and Mycenaean periods are just a place in history to study that transition. Looking at the two cultures' writing systems, Minoans used a yet-to-be-deciphered writing system called Linear A, while the Mycenaeans use Linear B, which is mostly deciphered. Linear B uses a combination of syllabic and ideographic characters. It is thought Linear A is similar. I'm not sure if that muddies the waters of the argument you presented in the series of episodes, but I agree that the premise uses a lot of generalizations to try and make a point. Just thought I'd share this lesser-known slice of history. The Minoans are a particularly interesting people, and I think they don't get enough attention, so I like to talk about them when I can. Keep up the great work, guys.
Well, that's a great email. Thank you, Amelia. So, I do think the Minoans are interesting, and we should do more to study that. One of the things that comes up here is something I guess we got at a minute ago, the question of actually how female-friendly these earlier, lesser-understood cultures actually were. Now, one of the types of feedback we got from some classic scholars after the episode was like undermining the idea that there's this popular idea that there was this sort of universal, worldwide, matriarchal, goddess-based culture before there was civilization and before there was written history. And there's a lot of evidence that that's just not true. Mm-hmm. Now, the question might be, was the pre-literate, pre-civilization society more female-friendly or more matriarchal, but maybe not actually matriarchal?
Yeah, like I don't even think Schlein made the argument, at least in the book we discussed, that culture was ever largely matriarchal.
Right.
It's just a question of was it more balanced at some point?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think that is certainly an area of discussion. You know, another thing that came that came to mind when I was reading that and keeps coming back now is that regardless of what the previous gods or goddesses were, there's always this – it seems like there's this there's this movement to repackage them, sometimes as lesser deities or as just outright demons.
Yeah.
And you have to ask yourself, well, is this always, to what extent gender is playing a role into this transformation, or is it a transformation that is in many areas removed from gender concerns? The various pagan gods that were reduced to demons in the advent of Christianity, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, and you wonder about the idea of if there are gender correlations with the history of the understanding of snakes mm-hmm. in religion, because Amelia brings up the Garden of Eden story. And one of the funny things about the Garden of Eden story, mm-hmm. do you know it never says the snake is Satan?
Oh, yeah.
That's not in the story. It's just the snake. It's just the snake comes to Eve, the woman, and tempts her with knowledge of good and evil.
Yeah, I mean, I do know, of course, that when you look at the Bible, Old and New Testament, the devil is kind of this character where it's almost like somebody wrote a really confusing screenplay.
Uh-huh.
And then someone said, God, we have a number of these antagonists. Can we just combine these into one character? Because it's confusing to have a snake, and then there's this this Satan character that's like a court official, and then there's this idea of a fallen angel and another devil. Just let's make them all the same guy.
Yeah. I mean, it really does make you wonder, though, if the snake is in the Garden of Eden story a sort of reflection of an earlier story tradition where the snake is something more like a Prometheus character, mm-hmm. a character that brings knowledge to the humans, and that character is transformed into a villain in later versions of the story.
Now, she also mentioned Medusa here.
Yeah.
I would love to do some sort of a deeper dive on Medusa in the future, because on one hand, always one of my favorite monsters.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't until I was really an adult that I began to notice just this trend in art and particularly with statues. There's one statue in particular. I don't remember the sculptor's name, but you find it at the Met in New York City,
mm-hmm.
where our hero is holding the decapitated head of Medusa aloft. And there are various paintings where he's in the act of slaying her. And there's like a really kind of icky, violent vibe to those images, the murder of this this feminine monster, monstrous female.
Well, this attack on this primordially ugly woman.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't sit well with me. I like the scenes where Medusa is dishing out death a lot more.
Well, as beautiful as mythology can be, it's also something we should keep in mind. I mean, cultural values are encoded in myths, and a lot of cultures have had lots of strains of deep, powerful misogyny running through them, and that's mm-hmm. there in a lot of the myths too.
Now, I do want to point out one more tidbit from the Alphabet and the Goddess episode. I referenced a particular paper by Laura Slatkin, titled the Rage or the Wrath of Thetis.
Mm-hmm.
She actually has a book that came out years and years ago titled The Power of Thetis and Selected Essays, if anyone is interested to read more of her writings.
Hmm.
All right. Well, what else do we have, Carney?
All right. Well, this next one is also about the alphabet and the goddess, and this is from our listener, Hend. And so she writes, "Hi, Robert and Joe. I was listening to the second part of the Goddess versus Alphabet episode, and the Sparta-Athens comparison struck me as either too good to be true or contrived. Now, we actually asked about that. We were like, I wonder to what extent Schlain is cherry-picking his argument here. And we asked for, you know, if you're a classic scholar mm-hmm. out there, if you're or an ancient Greek historian, you know, how does his argument strike you? And basically, his argument was that Spartan society placed far, far less emphasis on the written word, and at the same time was more friendly to women's rights and women's empowerment than Athenian society was. And Athenian society was highly litigious, highly literate, highly written word oriented.
Yeah, it was an interesting argument, but I think at the same time we were both a little cautious with it
yeah.
at the time.
So this is what Hind is getting back to us with. So Hind says, first of all, I don't think there's much validity to the left brain, right brain argument, besides interesting oddities to do with split brain patients. Have you guys done an episode on that? I emailed one of my former professors who is a professor of classics about this, and this is what he said. Quote, I'm always a little wary about big left/right brain arguments since I doubt the brain functions so simplistically, but what do I know? As for Spartan illiteracy, I think that is not so established. It is true that women had a lot more power over some things in Sparta, but I don't think the larger argument stands up since I don't think it has much to do with literacy. Most of the Spartan and Athenian institutions regarding women were set during a time when both were mostly oral cultures. And then she provides a link to an article, which I must say I haven't had time to read yet, but I would like to look into. So I appreciate that bit of feedback. That's an interesting point. So this could be a way that Schlain might not only be cherry picking, but might be like acknowledging differences that are sort of irrelevant because the practices he's pointing to were established before the written word was important in either culture.
That's a good point.
Now, to come back to the left brain, right brain thing, I think that's something that's important to strike a good balance on, because you can absolutely go overboard with the left brain, right yeah. brain kind of thing. At the same time, I think hemispheric lateralization is an important feature of the human brain. Now, I think there are a lot of arguments, especially in the later 20th century, that overinterpreted the influence of the left brain, right brain division. But the left brain, right brain division is a real thing, and it does have consequences. You just don't want to be overly general, overly simplistic about the power of it in explaining behavior.
Yeah, and I mean, similar things go for a lot of the research that has gone into the inner workings of the brain. Mm-hmm. For instance, going from the idea that there is, say, a pleasure center or a pain center of the brain to a more nuanced understanding that, well, it's not a center so much as a network.
Yeah, I mean, neuroscience is one of those things that's just not very friendly to amateur interpretation. Mm-hmm. And it's something neither of us are neuroscientists, so we have to do our best to just sort through the science and what people have written about it and try to make sense of it. But, you know, neuroscience is one of those things where it's almost never as simple as that headline you read.
It's true. I get a kick out of a juicy neuroscience clickbait headline almost as much as the black hole headlines.
You always see something that's like, you know, brain's God worship center activates when you view pizza or something. You know, you see those kind of studies and it's like that can sort of convey something that's kind of true, but it's not going to be really that simple.
Right.
So anyway, Hind, I think those are very good concerns to raise.
All right. Here's another one. This one comes to us from Mattia. And this one concerns our Fardanomicon episode.
Oh, yeah.
Hi, Robert and Joe. First-time email writer here, long-time listener. In your most recent mailbag episode, that would have been, I guess, the one before this, you talked about Pythagoras and his comments on fava beans.
Nice.
I never thought—
Do not eat beans.
That's right, because that was basically his whole deal, is he hated beans and said you should not eat them.
It's not his whole deal.
Well, not his whole deal, obviously, but it seemed to be of some importance to
yeah.
him.
Yeah.
She continues, I never thought about the connection between the Greek pneuma and flatulence. It makes a lot of sense and adds a lot to Pythagoras's maniacal sect.
Now, just to refresh, the idea of the connection between the pneuma and flatulence is that pneuma usually means breath. It's also, funny enough, the word for like spirit or ghost. So you'd mm-hmm. have like the Holy Spirit being a pneuma, and then you could breathe out a pneuma, but then also what would be another kind of pneuma.
Well, but Pythagoras is arguing here that you could essentially fart out your own soul.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's the basic idea as I interpreted it. She continues, however, there is a more widespread explanation for Pythagoras's take on fava beans. A common mutation among Mediterranean people is G6PD deficiency, which causes severe anemia upon exposure to certain compounds, including anti-malarial drugs, the antibiotic Bactrim, and guess what? Fava beans.
Oh, no.
The condition is commonly known as favism because of this effect. Ever the flamboyant explainer, Pythagoras observed this condition and prohibited his followers from eating these beans, which were said to contain the soul of the dead. Keep up the great work. There is no podcast like yours.
The soul of the dead in beans.
Yeah.
I didn't make it to that part, so thank you.
My son is distrustful of beans.
Really?
Yeah. And maybe that's why. He knows deep down that they may contain the souls of the dead.
Have they wronged him?
No, he just...
Did they betrayed him?
He just... Sometimes it's hard to get him excited about beans. I don't know why. For a kid who has sworn off most meats, it would benefit him tremendously to be just all in on beans. But it's been an uphill battle.
You know, you say he's into shellfish, though, right?
Oh, yes.
Shellfish and beans don't really go together.
It's true. Maybe that's it. Deep down, he knows that his favorite foods don't really work that well with that. But, on the other hand, I have had some wonderful like shrimp dishes that I think incorporate some forms of beans.
So. Oh, yeah. I guess now that I think about it.
I mean, not kidney beans, obviously, but, you know.
Not fava beans.
Yeah, not fava beans.
We all know that fava beans go best with human liver mm-hmm. and Chianti.
But hilarity aside, this is an interesting argument, the idea that there could be something else at play here besides just mere superstition and fart aversion.
Right. Hey, speaking of goddesses, we've got an email from Athena.
Oh.
At least that's her name, is from Athena on Pissmyers. You remember
yes.
Crazy Ants and we discovered the meaning of Pissmyers? Athena writes, "Hi, I've been listening to your show for a little while and I enjoy it. I was listening to your show on Crazy Ants and it's a topic very familiar having grown up in Texas. When you mentioned Pissmyers, I had to write in. My mother used that term to describe a specific ant that was around our home in South Texas, Victoria. They indeed smelled like their name suggests. A single ant didn't smell, but the ant hill sure did. Hmm. On a side note, if I or my siblings were misbehaving, she would call us Pissmyers."
well, that's great. We got to hear a little field wisdom on the Pissmyers here.
Now, I wonder if the ant doesn't smell like the name suggests, but the ant mound does. Why is that? Is it just because a single ant doesn't put off enough for us to detect and you got to have a lot of them in a close proximity? Or is it because, I don't know, of something else in the mound? Do they secrete stuff in the mound?
Yeah, I guess without actually looking into it, my guess would be the former, that it's just the fact that you have so many ants in one area at a time that it's going to, you know, create a stronger aroma, because these are not like leaf cutter ants. They're not cultivating anything in there.
Yeah.
So
anyway, I admire the harshness of your mother, by the way. I think that's good. I mean, normally you just call your kid, you say you're being a brat or you're being mm-hmm. a baby or something, but now you're saying like you're being a eusocial insect that produces urine like smells.
Well, that's kind of like children, except for the eusocial part. They do produce the smell of urine sometimes, and that can't be helped.
Maybe we should take a break. Are you ready?
Let's do it. All right, we'll be right back. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gagillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
All right, we're back. We're still on the bottom of the ocean. We're still trapped in the submarine with Carney, and he is dishing out some listener mail for us to read.
So are you ready for this epic email we got from Jesser?
Let's have it, yeah.
Now, Jesser is a pseudonym, and I don't know their pronouns, so I'm just going to go with they. So Jesser writes in to say, "Hey guys, since you were talking about sci-fi stories with a focus on Venus, I thought you might like to know about the book Radiance by Catherine M. Valente. It's an Art Deco-styled sci-fi novel set in a world where early 20th century depictions of space travel were true, and you really can shoot yourself in a bullet to the moon. It's also about the history of movie making in a way, and one of the main conflicts is a documentary that went awry on the surface of Venus. It's a really interesting book because it takes a non-linear, epistolary approach to telling its story. You know, in a way, you could look at the Soviet Venera Landers as a documentary that went awry on the surface of Venus. Yeah. But also, Dieser continues, "I also recently listened to the episodes on the bicameral mind, and it brought to mind one particularly old text I studied in school called The Instruction of Ani. It comes from about 1400 to 1200 BCE, sometime during the 18th dynasty of Egypt, and it's a moral code written in the form of advice from father to son. It came to mind particularly because it's both quite old and because it has a number of things you wouldn't expect to hear from a bicamerally minded people. Instructions against lying and being sneaky, for instance. It even ends with what's basically a debate between the son and the father about why the instructions should be followed, though Julian James would probably just say maybe Egyptians lost bicameralism early." Maybe, or I don't know. I could look at that and say, okay, I already don't agree that the bicameral mind is correct, despite how interesting it is, but that could be a good piece of evidence against it.
Yeah, I agree. It kind of depends where you how you want to cherry pick it. Really, I do like the idea that Jaynes might have argued that well, this is a case of the modern mind emerging early on in one of our most ancient civilizations. But who knows?
Yeah. In his defense, I think he would say that, you know, the process was gradual and it happened at different places and not all exactly at the same time. But then again, you could look at that as a weakness of the hypothesis, because if a hypothesis is too accommodating, you know, if you're shaping it to accommodate too many different kinds of evidence, that's often a sign that you're trying to cover your butt, really.
Right. And yeah, you get into this area where, okay, am I talking about an actual hypothesis at this point, or am I talking about something that is ultimately more philosophic or even religious in form? And I think there are value in those things as well. I've said before, I feel like my fascination with bicameral mind at times fulfills the needs of religion for me personally, you know.
And it's like almost like a novel you love or something.
Yeah. It fills in some of the sort of, I guess, teleological holes in my understanding of humans. But anyway, the idea of like a father and son having this conversation, I do like the idea of a father saying, "Look, son, all these other people are not exactly like us. You're going to be tempted to lie to these pea zombies because they're going to believe you. But we just can't live like that, you know, having that sort of a conversation.
Oh, man.
Imagining what it is like to be a modern human among bicameral humans. That's one of the issues that Terrence Hawkins got into in his book, The Rage of Achilles.
Oh, yeah. I still mean to read that, by the way.
Yeah, it's quite good. I'll probably go into depth more about that in our upcoming summer reading episode.
All right, so we should go on with Jesser's email. So Jesser says, regarding the recent episode on the relationship between gender roles and language, and that would be on the Alphabet versus the Goddess episode, I actually took a class on gender roles in the ancient world in college. The theory of the origin of gender roles I learned there had to do with the division of labor in hunter-gatherer society. So that's somewhat along the same lines as Schlaine's ideas. In hunter-gatherer societies in the modern era, it seems like the profitability of hunting versus gathering roughly determines the relative balance of male versus female power. If there's little vegetation to be found, hunting is more important and men have more power. Vice versa, if there's little game and in places where both are abundant, roles are roughly equal. Assuming that the same held true in ancient hunter-gatherer societies, you can construct a rough conceptual history where women would have been the first to develop agriculture, since they spent more time with plants, while men would have been the first to develop animal husbandry since they spent more time with animals. The fact that you can use animals to massively simplify agriculture could suggest that that's where the shift to male-dominated societies came from. The men who could harness the most animal power to produce the most surplus crops would be able to leverage that to gain political power. Of course, this is only one theory, and any one theory may not be broadly applicable considering in how many places the patriarchal sedentary societies emerged, but it's interesting to consider the ramifications of an early sex-based division of labor.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting possibility, maybe worth more of a look and to see what the evidence is.
Yeah, of course, it makes me think a lot about the domestication of animals and, you know, sort of an animal-by-animal breakdown about how it occurred, you know, like, for instance, the dog and cat model that I've seen presented sometimes where they essentially wander up to the campfire or the habitat.
Yeah.
In these cases, it seems like it would be the non-hunters who would be sort of on point for domestication.
Yeah.
Where, of course, it would probably be different if it was, you know, if you're talking about some sort of an ancient cow or a rock.
Well, yeah. If you're talking about animals that aid in agricultural production, you'd be talking about like large draft animals.
Well, or pigs.
Yeah. I think that's worth looking into.
Yeah. Or stegosauruses, of course.
Right, yeah.
Cambodian model. That's, I'm not serious with that, by the way. But these are
advocating Flintstonesism here from now on.
Yes, think to the Flintstones. They had so many different domestic roles for the animals. How did that happen? We need a strong hypothesis for that as well.
Okay, Jesser has some more interesting stuff. So Jesser says, also, since I'm an Egyptologist, first mention of this, by the way, but Jesser is an Egyptologist apparently, I've had a couple facts come to mind as I've listened to various episodes that might be interesting. First of all, in comparison to other religions, ancient Egyptian religion has an interesting inversion from the standard notion of sky father and earth mother as primordial gods. Now, we mentioned a lot of religions have that, and Yeser gives some examples, e.g. Gaia and Uranus in Greek myth, Ranginui and Papatuanuku in Maori myth. But anyway, continues saying that Egyptian religion had a sky mother, Nut, she even births the sun god every morning, and an earth father, Geb. Okay, next point Yeser makes. Egyptian religion has a couple of creation myths. As far as scholars can tell, this was not really a problem to ancient Egyptian priests. They have some similarities, often involving some sort of primordial mound and some act of self-creation to start the cosmos, but they involve wildly different sets of gods and varied between regions, yet there never seems to be any effort to unify or standardize the mythology. I think that's kind of interesting, like a lack of the canon impulse.
Yeah, the cinematic universe impulse.
Right. Next point. Part of the purpose behind the creation of mummies was basically to turn the body into a statue. The opening of the mouth rituals used to turn the mummy into a ritually charged object that the deceased person's spirit could inhabit are similar to the rituals used for cult statues for temples of the gods, which were similarly meant to enable the gods to inhabit the statues and to consume offerings. Egyptians had some interesting views on gender relations. For example, they thought that in terms of reproduction, women were basically empty vessels and that men provided all the important elements. This is not a unique view of
that. You're right. Yeah. I mean, it ends up being reflected in the spermist that,
right.
that we discussed in a fairly recent episode.
It's kind of not surprising that throughout history, a lot of men have decided that, oh, it's men who are actually the only important part.
Yeah.
But Yeser continues, while that sounds rough on women, it meant women were never really blamed for not being able to bear children. It was entirely the man's fault. That's interesting. They were also pretty relaxed about marriage, too. Premarital sex seems not to have been a big deal, and marriage itself was more of a legal/economic arrangement than a religious one. Women could even initiate a divorce if they wanted to. This is more a recommendation, but the book The Woman Who Would Be King, which is a biography of Hatshepsut's life by Professor Kara Cooney, has a really good scholarly exploration of Egyptian society. That sounds like a good read.
Yeah.
Lastly, I thought the story of Inigaldi Nana would be your sort of thing. Essentially, archaeologists were excavating a palace during the Neo-Babylonian Empire when they came across a bunch of artifacts from different places in much earlier times, all collected in one part of the palace. It turns out they'd stumbled onto a museum of artifacts from earlier Mesopotamian civilizations curated by the Neo-Babylonian princess Inigaldi Nana, complete with cuneiform seals for each artifact like modern museum labels. Also, her museum dates to about 100 years before Herodotus, quote, invented the study of history, goes to show you what good publicity can do. And then Yeser apologizes for the length of all this, says they wanted to keep adding one more interesting idea before sending off. Thank you so much for this email. This is great.
Yeah. They really managed to pack a lot in here. All right. This one comes to us from Niall. Hi, Niall from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Really enjoy the show's first time writing. When you were talking about life on a nuclear submarine, it reminded me of when I worked for Xerox in Los Angeles. I asked my district manager, what was the weirdest service call you ever did? He said he installed a Xerox 1090 copier on a nuclear submarine.
Why do you need to make copies on a submarine?
We'll get to that.
Okay.
So he had to take it apart and cut the frame with a torch to get it through the doors, weld it back together, and get it functioning. If you look it up, you will see that it is a very large copier. I ask him why on earth would they want such a huge copier in a nuclear submarine? He said, "Are you kidding? You have to have a form in triplicate to take a dump in the Navy." It makes me think that the modern-day nuclear submarine is a lot roomier than we might think. As for the focusing of the eyes in the confined environment, once I was picking a friend up from prison, which tells you the kind of friends I have, he had been in a small confined room for 6 months. And when he got in my car in New Mexico with vast landscapes, the first thing he talked about was the focusing of his eyes on the distant horizon. It really freaked him out, and he had a hard time adjusting. Thanks for everything you do. Keep up the good work.
Ooh, wow. That's kind of scary to hear there at the end. It makes me think prisoners should definitely be given windows, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, also, we've discussed on the show before just how horrible solitary confinement is as a form of essentially neurological torture.
Yeah.
It does a lot of terrible things to the mind, and we didn't. But I don't think we even really got into what it might do to your visual perception. But mainly, I just love the idea of a giant Xerox machine cut apart and then reassembled aboard a nuclear submarine just for bureaucratic purposes.
I looked it up. It looks kind of like a sideways refrigerator with some little like droid embellishments.
Yeah.
It's a cross between a sideways refrigerator and an R2-D2.
We really need more Xeroxes in our, especially our sci-fi underwater environments. Uh-huh. Like when I think back on The Abyss or Leviathan, Deep Star 6, what these films really lacked was a proper Xerox scene. You know?
They making copies.
Yeah. Six-pack from Leviathan, making copies. That would have been perfect.
Oh, he'd be the kind of guy who would Xerox his own posterior.
Oh, yeah. I mean— Yeah, there has to be a deleted scene now that I think about it.
You know, I must say, Carney is very excited now that we're getting to the email about submarines. He must be really enjoying his new job.
Well, yeah, and I mean, he's a little lonely down here, so he could use a Xerox machine to hang out with.
Oh, as a friend. Yeah. So it looks like he is excitedly giving us more submarine-related email.
Yes. In fact, this next one comes to us from an old friend, long-time listener mail participant, Jim.
Jim in New Jersey. Man, he writes some great emails, and this is another good one. Jim writes, Robert and Joe, I've seen Das Boot twice and been on a German U-boat twice too, but only in a museum. The U.S. Navy captured German U-boat U-505 during World War II. It's a museum attraction at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago. Oh, I wish I'd been to that last time we were in Chicago. I'd like to go sometime.
Yeah, well, next time.
Yeah. Anyway, Jim continues, I haven't seen the movie or been to the museum in years, but from what I recall, I visited the museum in two successive summers and saw the movie in between those two visits. Well, so you watch it twice in a year. This is kind of obsessive behavior, Jim. What's going on?
It's a great film. Das Boot. It's not like seeing Deep Star 6 twice in the same year.
Jim writes, my memory is that the movie set matched the sub very well. The movie features several scenes at the captain's office, his bunk and the officer's mess. These are all the same small part of the sub, which is not obvious from initial viewing of the movie, but more apparent once you see/know it. The space isn't much more than a nook along the sub's main passageway where there's a small bunk for the captain. There's a small table next to it. I can't remember if it's bolted down or whether it flips down like a Murphy bed. The captain is sitting on his bunk while in his, quote, office. Several officers are sitting on the bunk during meals, too. I wonder if that would mess with you psychologically, like if you had to conduct your official managerial duties in your office from your bed.
Well, certainly, I guess if it's slightly transformed, it might be a little different. But, yeah, meetings on beds are always weird. we've had a few of these when we're on trips doing live shows.
Oh God, you're right. Yeah, it's always weird.
Yeah, you don't really have we never have like a conference room to go to. I guess there's like a business area in most hotels, but if we're like running through the presentation, it generally ends up like two or three of us sitting on one of the beds that we're in the room that we're staying in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, Robert, come sit on my bed. Let's talk about H.H. Holmes.
Yeah.
But anyway, next time you're in a tense meeting with your manager, just imagine they're sitting on their bed, and I'm sure that'll undercut it. Anyway, getting back to this. The tour, when I was on it, consisted of walking through the three middle sections of the sub, and you can look into the fore and aft sections too. Holes had been cut into the hull, so you don't need to go up and down ladders. We could look up into the conning tower too. It didn't feel too cramped until we were told it was 60 men for 90 days with one toilet.
Oh, wow.
Technically, there were two toilets, but one was a food storage locker when they first left port. There was one fairly small stove right across from the captain's nook. The cook had to produce 180 meals a day from it.
I like how the second toilet is sort of like an achievement that they unlock.
Right.
Through eating food. Eventually they come to that point where it's like, congratulations.
Survive this long and you get another toilet.
We have a second toilet. Oh, and I guess
it incentive structures?
Maybe, but you know the captain pulled weight on that. It was like, oh, the new toilet's available. Well, I'm up because I've been waiting days for this.
That's my office now. Is it weirder to conduct meetings from a bed or from a toilet?
From a toilet, certainly. Yeah, like even if you're not actually like using the toilet, if you're just setting up on it as if it were a chair, then it's got to be a little strange.
Jim continues, the German Navy had a requirement that their boats had to go from surface to periscope level in under a minute. This was to hide from patrols. They would often drill this, and they do it in the movie. One of my favorite scenes, as the dive alarm sounds, the off-duty seamen run to the front of the boat, becoming human ballast to help the nose of the sub dive underwater faster.
Oh, yeah.
That is messed up. You shouldn't be using the – oh, my God.
No, I mean it drives home the extreme environment and the limits of the technology.
Yeah, I mean it makes me think of like those stunt car scenes in movies where somebody gets the car up on two wheels by like turning and leaning real hard.
Yeah, generally we just want to be passengers in our vehicles and not some component in its functionality.
Right. It's like imagine next time you're on an airplane and the captain's like, all right, we need to get ready for landing. So everybody please move up to the front of the plane.
Yes. Yeah. Nobody wants to hear that. All right. This one comes to us from William. William writes, thanks for the podcast. Makes my long bus commute more bearable. Two things related to the sleep and creativity podcast. First of all, you mentioned a future for hotels where they may be able to teach languages, etc., while you're asleep. Maybe I'm just cynical, but I suspect the more likely use will be advertising.
Yep.
Think of the money they could make selling dream space to advertisers.
That's a thing in Futurama, isn't it?
It is. There's this scene where Fry is first subjected to advertising in his dream, and He's outraged over it. He says, back in my day, we only had advertisements like on the street, on TV, and in the sky, but never in our dreams.
I think it's perfect. Doesn't he like he's at school in his underwear dream, but yes. Then it's like very stylish underwear and it's trying to sell him on it.
Yeah. I mean, Futurama touched on it. This listener mail touches on it as well, that if we open up a new place in our experience of reality where advertising could potentially grow, then we will find a way to grow it there. He continues, I have four kids, and before they were born, I very rarely had bad dreams. But at least once for each of them, I've dreamt about something horrible and tragic happening to them. I wonder if it stems from anxiety about their well-being or a way of my mind trying to identify the best way to protect them. Creativity and parroting, perhaps. Could dreaming be a survival mechanism in which one's mind draws on extreme scenarios for things that could happen in everyday life and create ways to address them? Like, did ancient people dream of creative ways to hunt? Or what to do if the mammoth suddenly turns on them? The person who dreamed of a solution got away, while the one who didn't was trampled.
I mean, I think that's an extremely compelling way of explaining the emergence of the imagination. Mm-hmm. Why do we have an imagination? I mean, that's a kind of strange thing. Do you think lizards have an imagination? I mean, maybe, but it seems kind of unlikely. It seems pretty clear to me that we have an imagination as a way of simulating scenarios without having to test them out.
Yeah.
Like you can imagine what would happen based on what you know, and that allows you to simulate something stupid that you might be about to do and then realize it's stupid and you shouldn't do it. But that applies to waking imagination. So how do dreams change that?
Yeah, I believe that's still an open question, but it's certainly one that is addressed in some of these models that we've looked at.
Yeah. In the episode where we talked about the usefulness or the potential usefulness of dreams, one idea is that dreams by sort of suppressing the part of your brain that censors thought allow you to explore much wilder types of imaginative scenarios, things that you would never go to in your waking life. And that might be useful as a way of sort of like increasing the mutation rate of thought experiments, mm-hmm. Doing stuff that your normal waking brain would never bother to try out, right?
Yeah, exactly. Though I guess it ends up becoming kind of complicated though when you seem to have some sort of simulation that is also just clothed in sort of ridiculous and garbled dream imagery.
Yeah. Oh, and unreality. I mean, yeah. That is a weird thing to think about dreams. I mean, if you're saying that the imagination is useful because it helps you simulate scenarios and figure out what to do in the real world, why do we have dreams where we simulate scenarios that where, say, the laws of physics don't apply, like you can fly and stuff like that? There just seems like that might not be actually useful if you're trying to simulate stuff that could happen in your life.
Well, unless it's more about sort of very basic synaptic connections, you know? It's like the idea of here's a game you're going to play, but the game is preparing you for some sort of combat scenario, mm-hmm. you know? Where you know the basic skills involved, or perhaps some the neural connections involved, match up to the real life experience as well as the fantastic experience that you're actually engaging in your mind during dreams.
Yeah, I think you're somewhat right. I mean, I wouldn't be say I'm fully convinced by the model, but there's something to be said for the fact that dreams spur you to go to places with your brain that you wouldn't normally go to. And as such, they might often produce imaginative scenarios that are not very useful to you, but occasionally produce some very valuable breakthrough. You know, they might be like higher risk, higher reward types of imagination use.
You know, I have to admit that I don't think I've ever had a dream that I remember, or a nightmare rather, in which something bad has happened to my son. The only thing that comes to mind is I did have a dream once where I went to wake him up, and like the next morning, and he was a teenager.
Oh no!
like he'd grown up overnight,
is something bad that happened to your son. That counts.
Well, it also seems it's like a very simplistic dream extension of the idea of like, oh, I don't want to miss my child growing up, or oh, my child is not going to be this young forever. Yeah. That sort of thing.
It's almost like the dream is an internal poem that uses metaphors and imagery to inspire you to behave in certain ways.
Yeah, though it's often a very stupid poem. Yeah. poorly constructed poem, but it's still
resonates. As most poems are.
Yeah, but you feel them. I mean, this is again, I'm talking about the general nature of dreams here that I think everyone can relate to. Mm-hmm. For instance, the nightmare. How many times have you had a nightmare that was just absolutely just terrifying, and you just woke up and, maybe woke up screaming, or woke up on the verge of tears, or just racked with anxiety? And then when you try to explain it to your significant other or someone else in the waking day, you just then realize how ridiculous it is, just how that all the fear that you experienced in the dream is completely absent when you just reduce it to a description of events.
Well, you're much more emotionally vulnerable in dreams, aren't you?
Yeah, and you're free from like the logical constraints.
Yeah.
Like, Roger Rabbit isn't scary, and there's no reason he would be chasing me with a mallet. But within the confines of the nightmare, that doesn't matter. All that is real is the emotion in the experience. Also, I say that, but Roger Rabbit is kind of terrifying when you really think about it.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
All right, this next one comes to us from Jessica. Jessica says, "Hello, I just finished an older episode about laughing during horror movies, and I thought it was incredibly interesting, especially the science and research about laughing and smiling. There was one phenomenon I found myself pondering over and wanted to know more about. Why do people, I'm generalizing, but often men, like to tell other people, women, to smile more?" This is something that comes up in culture a lot. I've read a lot about this. Jessica writes, "I'm a woman, and I can't tell you how many times throughout my schooling, both high school and college, and even in the professional workplace, I get told I need to smile more by male colleagues, or I'm told by female coworkers that I have the dreaded, quote, resting bitch face."
I'm not trying to put myself on a pedestal here, but I don't think I've ever asked anyone to smile more. Not out of any sense of nobility or anything, but just because I really don't want to see anyone's teeth.
I just tell people to wipe that grin off their face.
I just think I don't want to look at anyone's like mouth bones. You know, it's no matter how gorgeous or ghastly what you have there may happen to be. I'm fine not seeing them.
Never forget your teeth are outside bones.
Yeah, I don't necessarily need to see more of them. However much whatever dental display you're presenting currently is the appropriate dental display, and I'm not going to ask you to give me more of it.
I'm sorry. I'll try to smile less.
No. You're doing the right amount. But it's one of those things where I'm not going to look at someone and say, like, oh, well, you know, I like Joe, but I wish I could see more of the inside of his mouth. I wish I could see more of his teeth. You know, it's, I don't know, maybe I just, I'm not a, I don't worship the smile in the same way that certainly American culture wants us to worship the smile, that sort of Tom Cruise Hollywood smile, you know, that's the color of bleached bone.
Yeah, it just looks like my soul is hungry. Anyway, moving on. So is it an aura of unfriendliness that turns people off, or is there another reason that people like those around them to be smiling all the time? Especially if smiling is usually a sign of humor or uncomfortableness, because I can tell you when someone tells me to smile, if ever I do, it's not a friendly one. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you had come across any discussions of these situations in your research that could point me in the right direction for some further reading. I think that's a good question that might be something worth revisiting.
I do wonder, and this is, again, this is without any research at this point, but I wonder if there are any arguments to be made for the human smile especially serving as some sort of reproductive signal of, you know, reproductive fitness.
Huh.
To say, like, look at my smile. My teeth are healthy.
Oh, I wonder.
Therefore,
yeah.
I am a healthy mate. Though it probably, on top of that, you could make the argument that it then takes on all these various socioeconomic complications as well.
Oh, yeah.
In modern culture, because the smile is a way of saying, look how abnormally white my teeth are. Look how abnormally straight my teeth are. Clearly, I am someone of some means and refinement.
Right. I've paid doctors to make me this way. My soul is hungry.
But again, that's just off the top of my head.
Yeah. And another thing I know, I actually just saw a headline about this the other day, is the idea that smiling has different meanings in different cultures. Like, there's this whole idea of the Russian smile, right? Does the Russian smile mean the same thing that the American smile does? Mm. Or do these expressions actually have different valences within the culture?
Yeah, we may have to come back to this. I know we've recorded episodes in the past on the you know, sort of the fake smile and how you can tell a fake smile from a real smile, that sort of thing. But
yeah,
it's such an important aspect of the human experience. It could do with some revisiting.
Yeah. But also, Jessica, allow us to be a voice of encouragement. Smile when you want to smile. Don't smile when you don't want to smile.
Yeah.
Don't
absolutely.
Let anybody stretch your face unwillingly.
I may have mentioned before, my wife is a photographer.
Mm-hmm.
And part of being a photographer, of course, is, you know, sometimes you're asking people to do different things with their face and their posture. My son observes all of this. And then when he is given a camera, he will do like the 5 or 6 year old version of it. So he'll point a camera at me and say, all right, stand up a little bit. And then he'll say, okay, let me see your teeth. Show me your teeth.
Like it's a dentist.
Yeah.
Getting out the drill.
Yeah, and I'm like, no, this is enough. I'm not showing you any more teeth. All right, I have one here. This is coming to us from David. And this one is one of a few different messages that came in via the discussion module, which is it's the Stuff to Blow Your Mind discussion module. It is our Facebook group where you can have conversations and discuss topics with other listeners of the show, and then also sometimes with Joe and me as well. And anyway, David writes in and says, in the Finite and Infinite Games episode, there was a discussion of what happens in sports, in particular football, when they can't break a tie.
I think that ended with us saying, now we know we're about to get a lot of listener mail where people explain the rules of football to us, and it didn't happen.
Well, this was the only one. He started this one by saying, you knew this was coming. I think that was the title of his response. He says, I am from Sydney, Australia, and our football or rugby league has had some really long games. In the 70s, there were 2 grand finals, final games to determine the champion that finished in a draw and the game was replayed. But the game I wanted you to know about was a second grade grand final played before the main first grade game a few years ago. They changed what happens in a draw. The teams played the whole 80 minutes and had a draw. The rule stated that they play 5 minutes extra time. Then if no one scored, they change ends and play on until someone scores. The game went to the full 5 minutes. And then they played another 30 minutes until finally a team scored. That is 115 minutes in a game that has limited replacements and some struggle to play the full 80. It went so long that it interfered with the pregame concert entertainment for the main game. In theory, that game could have gone on forever, but would always remain a finite game.
Yes, it would.
I know most will not know the sport of rugby league, but it is a physically demanding game with limited stoppages. It is played in Australia, New Zealand, and Britain with a new team in Canada and a test match soon to be played in Denver.
That's probably about the sportsiest listener mail you're ever going to hear on here.
No, we might receive some more.
We'll okay.
See. I know we have sports fans out there.
Now, we're definitely going to record at least one other listener mail episode where the entire episode will just be people explaining the rules of football to us after they hear it didn't happen from this one.
But we'll leave that for another day. All right, we're going to take one last break, and then when we come back, more listener mail.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back.
All right, what have we got, Robert?
Oh, well, let's see. Yeah, I have some more here. Here's another short message. This one comes to us via the discussion module as well. Terrence writes in and says, "The recent episode on quantum immortality reminded me of a couple of Larry Nevin short stories from the late 60s, early 70s, All the Myriad Ways and For a Foggy Night. The former concerns the psychological consequences of the proof of an infinitely branching multiverse, not good, and the later, the possibility of an inadvertent crossing over between them."
So what are the consequences? Have you read these?
I have not read these.
Wow. I haven't read them either, so I don't know what to say about it, but appreciate the recommendation, Terrence.
Yeah, there was some back and forth on the discussion module about this from among individuals who have read these Larry Nevin short stories. But it does make me want to pick him up because he's very much an author that I've been aware of forever. I remember seeing his name when I would browse the science fiction section at the local bookstore as a kid. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, I never actually read any of his work.
Okay, so let's say there were a way to prove the quantum multiverse, to prove that, say, the mini worlds interpretation is the correct interpretation of quantum mechanics. Mm-hmm. And that actually does lead to, every moment, all these infinitely branching multiverses that you're splitting off into in uncountable ways. How do you think that would change how you feel about life? Would it change anything?
Well, I guess it depends on what you know. Like, how much do you know?
Yeah.
Like, do I just know that there is a parallel existence? Do I know what the differences are in like the most, the closest multiverse?
One version you can think of it is it might encourage people to think that their choices are meaningless because every choice they make in other worlds, they've made the opposite choice. Hmm. And so really what you are now is not the sum total of the choices you made from the available options, but you're just the version that made these particular choices and other versions of you have made different ones.
But how's that different from a lot of what we suspect about the nature of our reality? You know, questions of to what extent we have free will, to what extent we're just – that we're essentially without choice anyway, and we're just trapped on this rail.
Well, I mean, so I think the scientific case for the basic view of determinism is pretty solid. There's no way you can coherently say like, yes, I'm freely making choices and I could have done otherwise. There's no way you can prove that. But at the same time, we at least have the experience, the subjective experience of feeling like we are making free choices. So in a way, subjectively, it kind of doesn't matter, right?
Like
you can't prove that you could have done otherwise in some past scenario, but it feels like you could. And it almost seems like that's enough, right?
Yeah. And I tend to suspect that if we were aware of happenings in another universe that's closely aligned with what we're doing here, mm-hmm. I think we'd still be able to hold on to that feeling of freedom and free will. Mm-hmm. That we'd still live our lives with that in mind.
Yeah, I think you're right. And whether we could have done otherwise or not, you're now the person you are. And the person you are now is a result of choices you've made. So whether or not you could have done otherwise, with the reality that we're faced with is that you're the version of you that made the choices you did. We don't know whether there are other versions of you that made different choices.
Well, when I think about the multiverse approach, I tend to think, well, in most of those realities, I probably don't even exist. Or Earth doesn't even exist.
Yeah.
There's only a slim selection in which I'm a thing at all.
Right.
And, I'm probably doing pretty well compared to most of them. There are probably a lot of worse realities out there for me.
Another weird thing – well, yeah. I mean, another weird thing that brings up is though you are aware, say, if the mini worlds interpretation is true and there are these branching multiverses every time there's decoherence, mm-hmm. What does it mean to be you? Why are you this version of you? Why aren't you some other version of you? And are those other versions of you actually you or are they something else?
They're you too. But they're not the same you.
Yeah, they're what many worlds proponents call the edge.
It brings – it's like the question if you're asking like is that really – if that's you, then is that you as well, this you in another multiverse? But then the same question can be asked just along the timeline. Mm-hmm. Well, how about the you that went in to have their wisdom teeth removed? How about the you while you were under anesthesia? Mm-hmm. Was there a you at all during that span of time? And then now there's this you that you are embodying now.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
Does the multiverse go on with or without you?
I don't know.
Okay, we got one more email on the Quantum Immortality episode. We actually got a lot on this this episode. We don't have time to read them all, but here's one. This also came from Hind, who got in touch with us about the alphabet and the goddess, but Hind writes, quote, listening to the Quantum Immortality episode right now, just wanted to point out a slight error that Joe mentions. Although the Copenhagen interpretation is the interpretation that's in the majority of physics textbooks, it is in fact not what the majority of physicists believe is the right interpretation. There is no majority, though the Copenhagen adherents are the largest faction or the largest fraction. Many Worlds is not too far behind. Here's an article from Sean Carroll's blog about this. Also love the shout out to Tegmark's Our Mathematical Universe, one of my favorite pop physics books. So I don't remember saying that the majority of physicists believe that the Copenhagen interpretation is correct. I thought what I had said is that the majority of physicists had believed that. But if I did say that that's what they believe now, I accept that correction. It seems to be the most popular interpretation among physicists, but it's not the majority. It's the most popular minority. But what I definitely meant is that, you know, over the period of history where there have been interpretations of quantum mechanics, Copenhagen interpretation is what gets the most attention. And the difference, just as a quick refresher, is the Copenhagen interpretation says, you know, when you've got a quantum system in superposition, it's sitting there in superposition until interaction from the outside, quote, collapses the wave function. And then you've got a probability of that superposition going into one of its definite outcome states. So the classic example is Schrödinger's cat. So you've got the cat in the box and you've got a quantum system in superposition and something causes it to go one way or the other. And the idea is that the cat in the box is still alive and dead at the same time until you open the box and interact with it to see what's going on. And then it just assumes one of those two states. Many Worlds interpretation would say, both states are continuously correct, branching off into different universes that don't interact with each other.
Yes, but merely by putting the cat in this specially prepared box, you created two, like a branching path.
The wave function never collapses into one outcome or the other. They're just both equally real, going off into different directions that can't interact with each other anymore.
Yes.
But Hind is correct that that the Copenhagen interpretation appears to have been losing ground.
All right, here's another short bit of feedback from the discussion module, and this comes from Peter, who is a longtime listener of Stuff to Blow Your Mind and also a VR enthusiast. I'm always on the lookout for Peter's feedback whenever we touch on VR, mm-hmm. And he was responding to the Submarine Sleep episode. He says, love the Submarine Sleep episode and great points about VR and subs. I'd also be surprised if they weren't already experimenting with this. It'll be better once the more mobile versions improve in quality, but ideally, you'd have at least 3 meters by 3 meters space for them to move around in. Ideally more, but this would give them a fair amount of virtual freedom to feel like they were in a totally different world for a part of the day. I do wonder, though, if there'd be a danger of feeling more claustrophobic if you had this sort of regular freedom.
Yeah, that's a good question. Do you adapt to the claustrophobic environment so that it cuts down on your fear over time? You become desensitized to it. And it, like, if you get to look out windows or get to have a VR experience, going back to the sub is a more horrible thing.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great point. And also I like his point that virtual reality, we sometimes, especially those of us who are not actively engaging with current VR tech, we kind of get that sci-fi vision in our head where it's just somebody putting on a pair of magic goggles and then drooling for an hour. But there is a certain amount of physical space you need in order to then simulate greater physical space.
Yeah.
And that becomes a question too. Like maybe there's no room for that on the sub because you just installed that Xerox machine.
Yeah, yeah. Here's the question. What is the minimum space that you could have to put goggles on somebody and give them the illusion of absolute freedom of movement? Does that make sense? So if you want people to be able to walk around in mm-hmm. a VR world, you could manipulate their walking right through the sensory feedback so that instead of walking in a straight line forever, you eventually get them to kind of turn when they think they're going straight. What's the minimum space to cause that to be convincing as infinite movement space?
I don't know. I mean, it sounds like Peter's saying it's 3 meters by 3 meters.
That seems incredibly small. Surely that wouldn't work, would it?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it also depends on like what version of the technology you're imagining here. Is it essentially somebody still like sitting on a stool, or is there some sort of like a if they're walking on some sort of a treadmill. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know. It I think it depends on the rig too, and just like what version of existing or future technology you're talking about.
All right, this one comes to us from our listener, Andy. Robert and Joe, you asked in your Quantum Immortality episode whether anyone had entered an altered mental state after extensively restoring save states in video games.
Ah.
So this was your concept of saves coming, right?
Yes, yes.
So you create these backup versions of the world you live in. Every time you mess up, you go back to the checkpoint and start over.
Mm-hmm.
So Andy writes, I'm ashamed to admit that I once spent a riveting 6 hours save scumming various Mega Man titles. The classic. Mega Man's a great one. I then got into my car. Ooh, that. I wonder where this is going. I missed my exit and had a moment of confusion as I reached out for a redo mechanism.
Oh, wow.
Perhaps the oddest part of the experience was that I was seeking a mechanism outside my perceptual reality. It felt similar to how the world expands when you step back from an intense round of video gaming, becoming aware of the room around yourself. While it was not a full-blown out-of-body experience, it left me a bit disoriented. Needless to say, it didn't work, and I had to turn around at the next exit. Thanks for the many excellent episodes. I think stuff like this is really interesting. One thing Jaron Lanier talks about is how one of the most interesting things about virtual reality is that it can change not only your perception of the environment around you, but change your perception of what your own body is.
Mm.
So like you can put somebody in a virtual reality simulation where they have a tail and they can do things to control their tail. And that very quickly people actually adapt to this and start to feel like, you know, the movement of the tail feels intuitive to them. They've got a prehensile tail they can move around and use. And the ways you could apply this can get weirder and weirder. And it's fascinating that our brains are plastic in this way. They can adapt not only to changes in the environment but to changes in the physical makeup of the self. And I like the way this extends that principle, not just to like having a different limb, but to having different sort of metaphysical capabilities, like restoring save states in time. It's weird that he incorporated that as a thing his body could do. Hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Essentially updated his body schema to represent this. This kind of virtual body.
Yeah, and the thing that doesn't even have a physical manifestation. It would be like control over the metaphysical elements of the world itself through some kind of body action.
Hmm.
And a classic example I think of this, I've brought up on the podcast before, is when I've been in parts of my work where I've been using documents or Excel sheets a lot or something like that. There have been times when I, in physical space, tried to control F, you know, like I wanted to find something. I wanted a search function. But it takes you a second to realize like that doesn't exist in reality. But I thought my body could do it onto physical space.
Huh. Fascinating. I don't think I have anything directly to compare to that. Though on the video game front, I do remember when, you know, if anyone's familiar with, what is it, Katamari Damacy?
Oh, where you're trying to – that's the game where you roll up the ball of
yes,
things?
Yeah. I remember playing – like when that first came out, we were all super into it, and my wife and I were playing it. And then I went to drive to work,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't actively try and drive my car over things and roll them up into a ball. But there was like this weird feeling like I should be able to do that.
Yeah.
That thankfully quickly vanished. But yeah, it's interesting to think, especially as we get into technologies that will enable us to mm-hmm. take on new forms, certainly in the virtual realm, you know, to what extent does it become too weird to come back to our own bodies, too shocking even?
I mean, this makes it – yeah. It makes me wonder if, like, is there anything we couldn't train ourselves to internalize?
Mm-hmm.
If things as weird and non-physical as, say, like a search function or like save scumming or, you know, restore states, those things are nowhere to be found in the physical world, but we can internalize them as something that I expect my body to be able to do. Where does it stop? What else could you get your body to expect that it can do?
Yeah, the sky's the limit.
That's a homework assignment for you listeners. What sort of like metaphysical capabilities do you think you could train people to expect to be able to carry out just by running them through some virtual reality or video games or something? good or bad, obviously.
Yeah, indeed. I like the idea of thinking about what are some of the beneficial ones.
You know,
could you one day have a situation where here's a video game, you play it, and it's in some way like enhancing your abilities to operate as a functional human in the real world?
Yeah, I mean, I think about like self-editing technology, technology that would give people more willpower. You know, we're very, very impulse-driven. We're very driven by habit, by impulse, by sort of momentary desires that are in conflict with our long-term goals and desires. This is why social media apps are so addictive and stuff like that. They leverage our impulses against our long-term goals for our time use and stuff like that. Could you get people through some kind of VR or video game training to sort of reprioritize, to like prioritize their long-term goals up higher in the chain of action?
I don't know. And then how would you incorporate a first-person shooter mechanism into this so that it would sell enough copies?
Well, I don't know. I don't think it has to be a first-person shooter.
I think it does. It looks like what most of the games are, or it needs to be a sports game, one of the two, or a Jedi game.
You know, I'm going to make a very weird prediction. I think someday we will move beyond the first-person shooter. People think that it's going to be what video games are forever. I think someday in the future, the first-person shooter will just be an obscure genre that was very popular in the past.
It'll give way to the first-person stabber. That'll be the primary mode of interface there. Huh. But no, I hope you're right. I hope you're right. But it seems to be stuck with us for now. All right, we have time for one last listener mail. This one comes to us from Hope. Hi, Robert and Joe. I just recently listened to your episode on aphantasia and thoroughly enjoyed it. While I was looking more into hyperphantasia, it came to my mind that I have very vivid dreams. My husband is stunned sometimes at how well I can recall events, colors, and physical sensations. I've always thought it was strange how when he has a dream, he can hardly seem to remember any of it, if any at all. I thought to myself, is that how differently our minds actually work, like the difference between aphantasia and hyperphantasia? My question to you is, would you consider doing an episode on vivid dreams and their causes, differences in individuals, etc.? I would love to hear what you could find out. Lastly, I want to thank you for making my work days go by so much quicker. I'm lucky enough to work at a place where I can listen to podcasts almost all day and am slowly working my way through the episodes. The best part is feeling like I've achieved something by learning about the different topics at the end of the day, you know, other than the confused looks my coworkers start giving me when I start ranting about things like pee zombies and bicameralism. I wish you all the best. Yours, Hope.
Well, we're glad we can subjectively shorten the impression of the length of your life. No, that's not how it works, is it?
No, well, it's an increase in quality.
Yeah.
Even if it seems to be a relatively decrease in quantity.
I think we talked about this. I think it might have been from the work of David Eagleman, where we talked about in the time and the present moment episode.
Yeah.
Where it's counterintuitive, but if I'm remembering correctly, I hope I'm not getting this wrong, but basically experiences that seem very long in the moment are actually compressed and shortened in memory, whereas experiences that go by very quickly in the moment are lengthened in memory.
Yeah.
So that like you get a retrospective lengthening of the life by having things by having interesting, exciting experiences that go by very fast, even though it feels like it's happening faster while you're doing it.
Now, on the topic of vivid dreams, certainly. I mean, dreams are a topic that I feel like we'll never exhaust on Stuff to Blow Your Mind. We'll inevitably come back to dreaming and sleep in the future, nightmares and what have you. So that would be an interesting angle to take, you know, aside from some of these we've discussed lucid dreaming before, but on a, you know, much simpler question, you know, what is the difference between a vivid dreamer and, say, a more typical dreamer?
Do you find that you have more vivid dreams when you are in a more emotionally vulnerable state?
See, it's hard to say because I'll have vivid dreams that are so boring that I forget them before I wake up, you know? Like, and then sometimes a dream isn't that vivid, but it had an amazing idea and there's some amazing bit detail to its substance, and that'll stick with me.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of comes back to that basic bit of dream journaling wisdom to write it down immediately after it happens.
Yeah.
And I almost never do that. So it all becomes kind of lost in the shuffle, which I remind myself, I think it's supposed to do that.
So, man, this has been an epic listener mail episode.
Yeah, we've covered just about everything.
Yeah, let's see. We got some good criticisms of mm-hmm. Alphabet and the Goddess, some interesting tangents related to that. We got quantum immortality. We got nuclear submarines. God, we got all kinds of stuff.
Reading suggestions, episode yeah. suggestions. And we definitely want to remind everybody that, yeah, when you come across some topic that you would like for us to cover, some angle on a past episode mm-hmm. that we glossed over or missed, you know, whatever, do write into us. Again, we don't always have time to respond to you individually or to even feature them all on listener mail, but we do read them all. So we are always open to feedback.
Oh, it looks like Carney is getting an ELF signal from the surface saying that we need to surface. There must be – we got to go to periscope depth.
All right. Well, let's do it. In the meantime, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership. That's where you'll find all the episodes of the podcast as well as links out to our various social media accounts. I'll remind everybody that the best way to support the show, which we provide to you free of charge, is to go to wherever you obtain the podcast and rate and review us if at all possible.
Huge thanks, as always, to our wonderful audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us directly to let us know feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, maybe get some listener mail featured on a future listener mail episode, you can always email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch stratacoaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.